wanted to. So we have sort of a recap on what we talked about last time, because that was an interesting discussion.
One of the major points that we came upon in our last conversation was that which you think is sequential is really not.
May not necessarily be sequential. Yeah.
Right. And the reason we said that was today's typical consolidated enterprise environments, what is normally an isolated sequential workload by virtue of having some degree of consolidation, you have, say, for example, log files, multiple transaction log files in the same LUN, which is, of course, no longer purely sequential, but randomized to a certain extent relative to the number of log files you have living on a particular disk device.
Right. That was a very good point.
And I think that holds true also for consolidation in the virtualization environments. Is it's not technically feasible to achieve the return on investment that virtualization promises to say, here's, in the case of VMware, one data store and you put one machine on it. I think they have a limit, 255 LUNs that they can handle from each host. But the degree of machine consolidation that you get into a VMware cluster today far exceeds the 255. So that's, again, even if you could do that, you'd hit a limitation that would rob you of the value of the product. So again, as VMware's noted, you start to consolidate these workloads onto a disk device and it introduces randomness. What degree, that's a little more difficult, but it's still not purely sequential.
Yeah, so what you're saying is that in a single LUN, I can have multiple VMDK files that are serving multiple virtual machines, even though each virtual machine workload may be sequential. What I end up seeing in the end at the LUN is a random workload. That's true.
Or a random workload, but with a bursty sequential
behavior. With a bursty sequential behavior, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense too. Right.
And I think that's becoming more and more the case. And I think we noted the exception to that was the one huge scale vertical ERP where you might have an application of sufficiently large size that it is the only thing in the database service or the only thing on this server. And it's not virtualized or consolidated, and then its workload might tend to be very sequential. In particular for a database on the transaction log, but not on the data drive.
Yeah, I mean, also large enterprises that run big databases like eBay, and they might have similar properties also. Because eBay probably has tens of thousands of databases, and some of them probably are pretty big. And so those big databases, you probably have, you know, provisioned a single database instance and on a single machine, perhaps, and that would lead to the sequential workload that you might actually see at the LUN.
Right. Or something like also NASDAQ or Amazon.
Or, yeah, exactly.
And just for the core competency of the business, I think, because that's a very expensive model to follow. I think for the core competency, you might find that. But for all of the peripheral applications that are important to the line of business but are not the core competency and don't require that global sub-second response time like NASDAQ or eBay or Amazon, I think you'd probably find that they're consolidated by virtue of commodity hardware being cheap.
Yeah, that might be the case, certainly. So what else did we observe?
I believe we also said that in regards to the worst case possibility in SSM, which is where you have one particular workload that could thrash the other one by virtue of consolidating these two onto a larger set of spindle, and the workload, say workload B, was dedicated a fixed amount of spindle on purpose to isolate it because it has this interruptive workload characteristic by putting that together with a larger set of spindles that came from another workload, that workload B could now expand its footprint onto all of the disk and adversely affect workload A.
Right.
And I believe we said we could look at a stream prioritization to mitigate the worst case using proportional share scheduling.
Correct. So that, I think that's important, because without that, the you could arguably make a statement that the worst case performance of for a specific workload on an SSM could be worse than the worst case performance of the same workload on a DSM.
Yes.
Right. So not looking at array performance, but looking at the workload performance.
The host perceived performance.
The host perceived performance can be worse than, in the worst case, be worse than the host perceived performance in the DSM, right? Yeah, so that's, I think, an important point, too.
And I think that approach would bring logical segregation into the array and maintain host-attached performance characteristics.
Mm.
And it's known that you have a poorly behaved application, you segregate it off to itself and you let it destroy itself. And users are used to, hey, this is a very poor responding application.
Right.
Or
you don't segregate it as much as, let's say, give it a lower priority, right?
Well, that's what I mean by segregation. Mm. I'm thinking, for example, in VMware, if you have a machine that has terrible algorithms in it, for example, it's very CPU intensive, you assign lower share-based assignments to that virtual machine. It says, okay, you can cook yourself at 100%, but you're not overrunning everybody else because you have polynomial algorithms where you should have done something more intelligent.
Right. Okay, I think those are very valid points, too. What else? Did we have anything else? Or those were the highlights, I guess?
I think those were the highlights.
Mm. Okay.
I think that's it.
Okay, so what should we talk about today, then?
I didn't want to talk about the model.
Mm.
Well, that's what we were going to talk about.
Okay.
However, I wanted to talk to you about the experimental methodology.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned something quite interesting over the weekend that I had never bothered to look at.
Okay.
But I/O meter configuration files are nothing but text with some particular format.
Mm.
So that being said, I have been working on, because I started to create my meter configurations by hand, and that's very tedious and slow.
Mm.
And for the number of micro benchmark scenarios that I could be running, that number can blow up really fast and take a very, very long time to create by hand. And then I realized that I still have to run these tests. And that in and of itself could take some time, although I'm not so worried about that because I read up on the command line interface for IOMeter, and I think I've come up with a clever way to get all of my test suites to automate themselves.
Hmm.
And then grab the results and do a little bit of programming in Excel, and I can automate the generation of the graphs as well. So I'm not so much worried about having thousands of results, result files, and thousands of configurations, because I can automate the execution of those, and I can automate the chart generation and results analysis for all of those.
Hmm.
What I've now run into, and I'm not quite pleased with this algorithm, is I wanted to come up with a way to generate pairwise tests on two LUNs of different workloads. And for that algorithm, output a configuration file for IOMeter that I could then use in an automation script that would just iteratively run them one after the other, and I could just fire and forget and let them run for 5 or 6 days, and whenever they're done, I'll just go pick up my results.
Hmm.
Rather than sit there and fire one off by hand.
Sure, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Plus, I'll get a wider spread of experimental results back from that than if I said, okay, I'm just going to pick typical database LUN and say 80% random, 20% sequential for data, 70% read, 30% write, and transaction log looks like this. And then pick a smaller set that's more representative, perhaps, of what the real world would see, because I think I'm going to defer that for the block traces.
Mm.
And say, okay, here are the experimental results. This is the bottom up. Here's the model work. Now, on top down, we think we got it. And now we'll take some block traces and run them against that and see what we get out of it to kind of validate, prove or disprove what it is that we've been working on. So,
one thing which you want to do, though, which I'm assuming you already factored in, is that as you automate these, you also want to, let's say, at least get the initial set of results to make sure that everything is going right, sort of do the monitoring, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess you thought about that.
And I've been through several iterations of this. Mm. My initial all pairs, all possibilities, step by 5%.
Mm.
And then step by exponential outstanding IOs yielded several thousand test configurations.
Wow. Yeah.
And I said, this is going to be hard. But I said, and if they blow up, I have a problem. So I said, what we'll do is I'll just take the top 10 and then put together my automation script, run it, get back my top 10 results, which would take, I don't know, maybe 20, 30 minutes to do that.
Mm.
Look at them, inspect them individually one by one, and say, yes, they function as expected. Copy all of the configuration files into one directory and fire off the automation script and say, go do that for every one of these in here. And I'll see you in a week.
That makes sense, yeah.
So yeah, I realized that it would be dangerous just to fire it off without validating it and say, I ran it for a week and now I've lost a week of time in terms of experimentation because my results are all mangled and it's kind of pointless.
Yeah, I think that's smart. So maybe you can walk me through some of these parameter configurations.
So what I've got is starting with the transfer size of 4K,
mm-hmm.
probably the most common.
Yeah.
And then stepping exponentially up all the way up to 128K.
Mm.
For each transfer size, take 100% read. And then within that, take the randomness, start at 100%, and decrement by 10% down.
Yeah. Well, you could also reduce the number of, you know, so start with the coarse grain resolution. And then if things do not, you cannot come up with rules very clearly, then you can make the resolution even more fine-grained. For instance, you could do, instead of walking by 10%, you could walk by 20%.
Okay.
Right, or 25%, or you know, a higher value, at least for the first round of data.
Okay.
And then if you see, well, I need to run these other tests for me to fill in the gaps so that it all makes sense, so that I can derive conclusions that are valid, then you could go through a second round of those.
I did something like that because I originally started 1% was not feasible by virtue of the sheer number of pairings I got out of it.
Yeah.
But I started with 5%.
Mm.
And then I realized that that was going to take too long in terms of being able to harvest the first set of results to look at. So I went with 10%. I'm hesitant to step down in granularity any more than that because a lot of the literature I've read says, and I think even Galati said this in his presentation, it is right around the 10% mark where these corner cases occur. So that step from 100% sequential to 90% sequential radically changed his model. Those are the corner cases he discarded. So I'm afraid if I don't run it with enough granularity, I might miss the corner cases the first time.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, certainly that.
And I really wanted to do 5% because it would catch the very edge, the middle between the beginning and the end of the corner, and the other end of the corner case, which sits at 90%.
And you can specify this in the IO meter configuration file, how much random, how much read percentage, and so on. Okay, cool.
And then for each percentage, exponentially step the outstanding IOs.
And even that can be specified in IO meter?
Yes. Okay. And even burstiness. I mean, it's a very powerful tool.
That's what they used in the Basel study, right? They used IO meter, I think.
Yeah. I think they used IO meter, and then they went on to the DVD store, swing bench, and they went on to more real-world type applications. But for micro benchmarking, I think IO meter is really
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It's really good.
Yeah.
What I'm not happy with, because what I'm trying to do is create two workloads, one on each LUN, assigned to a DSM at first, run all of these configurations, get my results, then destroy the LUNs, pull the spindle together, recarve the LUNs, and run the exact same configurations against the LUNs. What I did, and I'm not even quite sure it's going to show me the data I want, I'm not pleased with it, is I did the complement, read-write, complement randomness for each step in the algorithm. So on LUN 1, if I had 100% read, 100% random, for the first workload, the complementing workload on the other LUN would be 100% write, 100% sequential. And now I think that effectively will show my worst case, but I think I'm robbing myself of the results of doing things that...
That might occur in practice.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm having a really hard time.
Yeah, so...
And I cut it off at 50% because I noticed they did... They look like this. For my experiments, if this is LUN 2 and this is LUN 1, at some point when the stepwise, the downward steps in randomness and read-write for LUN 1 cross the 50% threshold, since what I really want to do in the end is benchmark both of these workloads together, moving this one past this line is essentially this workload over here. There's kind of a symmetry about it.
Yeah.
So I said, when I get to the 50% mark, stop, because what you're going to end up doing is when you run these on the SSM is you're going to run the same test twice.
Yeah, makes sense.
So I was able to significantly cut my my configurations up by slashing them in half.
Yeah. The cases that you don't cover, though, is 100% random and 100% random.
Right.
Those sorts of things. So, yeah. I mean, those configurations are also certainly important, and we might not be able to escape from considering all possible combinations, right? If we want to do a comprehensive study, it would just take longer to run the experiments. One way to sort of speed that up would be to reduce the resolution here, right? And there are some problems with that, but maybe we can sort of be more finer resolution on the corner cases and sort of coarse grained in the mid ranges, right?
Okay.
That might be a possibility especially when you do the combination. So you can do sort of 100%, 90, and then directly move on to 70 and 50, right? So you can skip two configurations there if you want.
And all the associated pairs that come with that.
So that's one way to deal with the exploding number of combinations.
Yeah, because it grows really fast.
So you have 100% read, 50% read, and 0% read, right? Those are the three different cases you're looking at.
Well, I have that's the dot dot dot.
Oh,
because it steps down by 10. I wanted to draw the endpoint. The midpoint and the other endpoint, and I did that to verify that symmetry was going to essentially swap the workloads from LUN to LUN, which is kind of pointless because it's not something that I would have run the same test twice.
Yeah.
And then I said, okay, when you get to the midpoint, stop right there because you're going to be symmetric on the other side.
True.
Stop, because when I put them on an SSM, that's pointless. I'll end up running the same test twice.
Yeah,
the DSMs, I'll just get, because they're the same disk, the same chassis, the same host, the performance I got for him at 100, 100 will be the performance I got for him down here at 100, 100.
Though there will be a slight difference because if you run reversed workloads, the workloads get different portions of disk drives, right? So if you cut the LUN across, then first LUN will have a higher bandwidth than the other LUN, right? Because I don't know how these LUNs work for these large arrays, but I would expect that each disk is being cut into two lungs. I mean, two partitions that go to these two lungs, right? So the bandwidth on the outer tracks of the disc will go to one lung, whereas the slower bandwidth on the inner tracks of the disc will go to the other lung. But it doesn't really matter all that much. I think it's still okay to ignore that artifact of asymmetry. It's not such a big deal.
Okay. Well, what I had...
Yeah, you can write there. Sure.
What I was... The reason the symmetry and that artifact, I didn't factor that in, is for the DSM experiment, I would slice off this piece here and this piece here, starting at the same offsets of multiple discs.
Sure.
So the symmetry truly was symmetric all the way down.
For the DSM?
For the DSM.
Mm.
For the SSM, it gets a little more complicated because that artifact does come into play. Cause
yeah. Yeah, but I would not worry too much about it, right? I mean, it's sort of interesting, but perhaps it won't influence results all that much.
So
what about outstanding IOs? What are you thinking about that? 1, 2, 4, 32K?
1, 2, 4, 8, 16, and 32 outstanding IOs.
Per second?
Per second.
That's pretty small.
Wait, 1, 2, not per second, overall outstanding IOs. So basically, when you configure IO meter, you can say, for a given workload, you can have one outstanding IO, which is essentially synchronous. As soon as you do that one, I will send you the next one. One is the zero.
I see.
Because the one that's outstanding is the one you sent. Two. 4, 8, 16, 32.
How many IOs do you send out and not have to wait for the response?
Right.
I see.
Now, there are limits all over the place into how many outstanding IOs can be handled by different aspects of the system. Most commonly, it's going to be 255. In terms of outstanding IOs, and that's usually on the host side, because there's host memory involved with system-wide outstanding IOs that I can keep track.
And also, it's probably SCSI driver and the driver limitations as to how many the protocol allows.
Right.
In terms of the number of outstanding IOs you can send out to the disk.
And I think SCSI is also 255.
I think SCSI is higher in my opinion. It's 2 to the 32, if I'm not mistaken.
Is it?
Number of outstanding IOs, but serial ATA is much smaller. It's maybe 8 or 16. It's like really, really small. It's SCSI, from what I can remember. It is.
You're right. It's bigger. It's 2 to the 32.
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading that in the SCSI versus ATA paper.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is it's not outstanding IOs per second, but there is another aspect, which is the rate at which you run these workloads, right? I mean, how many IOs per second do these workloads issue? That determines the load.
I have them set to go as fast as they can.
As fast as they can, which is not true in practice, right? I mean... there is always some sort of rate of access.
Governed by a higher level element in the stack.
Yeah,
usually.
Like an application that would issue so many requests, let's say a web server that issues requests based on the incoming request rate. So that's the other aspect. I'm trying to think how that influences
think time. Is really what we're talking about.
Yeah, think time, exactly.
Think time is what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. I was having just this conversation earlier with these guys, with David and company, about think times and the ability to control the rate or the load on the system. A sequential, a random workload at a low rate may actually do pretty well, but a random workload at a high rate may do substantially worse. So I don't know if that's something you want to look at as well or not.
Thinking about that, I think from the perspective of the array, pushing them through as fast as we can get them, which is minimal think time, I think would reveal the more beneficial aspects of the model. Because think time might only help us in terms of delays between I/O arriving at the array's perspective.
Right. But I'm thinking about from the model's utility standpoint. If I want to use this model to determine if an SSM is the right thing to do for these two sets of workloads, does my model require to be parameterized in any way to capture the load induced by each workload?
I
don't know. Maybe the answer is no.
I think the generic model might. Because that now, that starts to play into the probabilistic nature of contention for the shared spindle model.
Right.
It's not just the workload's characteristics and how many, it's a function of the workload's characteristics plus how many workloads I have and their characteristics, and breaking their characteristics down, it would be read-write percentage, random sequential access, and think time, probably, and transfer size.
Right.
And it really starts to get complicated.
It does get complicated, yeah. So, for instance, let's take the simple example where I have a workload issuing sequential requests at a high rate. So, which means that at any given time, I have maybe 32 outstanding requests, which are all sequential, right? And it's maintaining that rate of requesting. And then there's another workload that's also doing sequential, but it's doing really slowly. It's doing 1 per second. If you combine the first workload with another workload, then the burstiness of the sequentiality, right, it's not really burstiness, but just the fact that there are so many sequential requests dispatched back to back that can all be serviced pretty much at the same time with perhaps one large sequential I/O or you know, within a short period of time, allows better multiplexing of all the spindles, right? So you can do a whole bunch of sequential requests and then move on to the next one instead of the latter workload, which is issuing sequential IOs, but so slowly that you sort of do this back and forth. Like, remember the anticipatory IO scheduling paper? They had this observation with synchronous IO. These latter workload becomes a synchronous, effectively a synchronous workload, right?
So and that, I go do something else and then have to come back to this.
Yeah, so that's, so although they have the same sequentiality percentage, their performance could be very different in terms of latency, right? So that might be something to think about, but perhaps we can leave this angle for later. Also because I've sort of pushed the other guys to look at this specific aspect of the problem. And we might get to learn something from them, and you know, maybe we can have a more combined knowledge at the end. But perhaps this is something for us to explore at some later point.
Makes
to make it more practically usable, right? But there might be a way to sort of completely circumvent this issue and still come up with reasonable recommendations without knowing this information. I don't know. There may be, yeah, it may be possible. I don't know.
It gets nebulous that far out.
Yeah.
And this is And going back to the proposal, I just listed out all of the possible things that could affect me.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember your comment, a simpler model is easier to reason about.
Sure.
But I don't find a way to construct a model of simple parameters, very simple in terms of its variables, that can accurately represent the truth about what goes on when it comes outside of a laboratory.
Hmm. I think what we need to really work on, like I said at one of our previous meetings, is to come up with a model for the integrated, the consolidated workload, right? And it's not clear, that seems to be a non-trivial task.
And
especially if it's simpler if you assume that both workloads are going at full blast, which means there's no idle time. And we introduce the idle time, then it becomes more complicated. But the problem is already complicated, even without this consideration. So
mm-hmm.
I think that's why it's probably reasonable to postpone this consideration until later.
And that's really why I had looked at the I/O meter configurations to say, forget that piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to look at the numbers that come back from putting these workloads together of different natures.
So I/O meter has a think tank variable as well? It does?
They don't call it think time, but they call it rate of transfer or something
mm-hmm.
like that. And it's basically the rate with which you send your I/O.
I see.
And they also, it's very, very good generic tool.
Mm. And it's directly on, it writes to the device directly? I mean, it doesn't go through a file system, right?
It does go through the file system.
It does go through the file system? So you need to have a file system on that line.
Yes.
I mean, another tool which bypasses the file system would be more easy to work with, right? So you don't have to set up a file system. I mean, does your file system need to be like spanning the entire LAN for it to actually access all these different, or does it actually create files to encompass the entire LAN? I mean, those kinds of questions.
It can, well, that piece you have control over.
Hmm.
You tell it how many sectors of the file system to use, and it creates a file that large. And if you don't specify it by default, it takes over the entire LAN.
Mm.
And then within that file, it
oh, I see.
Does random or sequential work.
Mm. Okay, that makes sense. That would work too.
And one of the, considering that, and because I didn't want to have encountered the same problem that the VMware guys had in Bazel with caching and prefetching, killing me.
Mm.
Why do my numbers look skewed for this kind of a test? Is I was going to disable the file system caching.
Mm. But I think they were talking about storage caching.
Right. And I was going to disable LAN prefetching as well and say, just do what you do and no memory in the middle. I want to see what the model of the disk behind it looks like. So I was going to go around and start turning off caches everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not the greatest for performance, but I think the most indicative of what's really happening on the back end.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, it's okay, file system, don't buffer my writes.
Mm-hmm.
Send them straight through. LUN, don't buffer my writes, send them straight through at the array level. LUN, don't try to predict my intelligence by figuring out I'm sequential and start prefetching blocks for me. That kind of changes my numbers too. And I was looking at, on some of the equipment, I may not have that flexibility, but on two of the three sets of equipment, I know I do.
Mm.
And so I was looking at the EMC array. And my initial concern was I couldn't just turn off prefetching for the whole array because my boss would shoot me in the head. Are you crazy? But I found out that you can turn it off on a per-LAN basis.
Oh, cool.
So I'll turn off prefetching, and I have two cabinets of disks that are currently idle that I'm working with. And so I'm going to cut my LANs from there and turn off the prefetch.
That's very nice, actually. That's very handy tool to have. Yeah, that sounds right. So when you run these tests, are you going to be competing with your production workload? Because, I mean,
spindles I'll be using
are dedicated, but what about the controller?
Is shared.
So especially when you're going at full blast, that might be an issue, right? Something to monitor for.
I was thinking about that.
Yeah.
Now, the array we currently own is well over-provisioned.
Mm.
So I don't think that I'm going to take a controller to its limit.
Mm.
I think I'll hit the spindle limitations first.
Mm.
I mean, I have to watch for that.
Mm.
But that is the slowest part of the system. And I think that's where my rate of transfer is going to be controlled at some points. I'm not worried. I am, but not too much,
mm-hmm.
about overriding the controller, per se, because the controllers are well-built to
mm-hmm.
handle large consolidated workloads. I mean, this array can handle up to 960 spindles.
Mm-hmm.
So the controllers are built to handle a lot of work.
Okay, yeah, that's really important. We don't want to mess up your production workload with our experiments, right?
And as the summer moves on, there is going to be an entire array,
mm-hmm.
a baby array, I call it, from
mm-hmm.
several years ago, that will be free in its own entirety
mm-hmm.
for experimentation in the summer.
Cool.
And so I'm kind of looking forward to saying, yeah, let me just get everybody off this one. This is mine for a couple of months. And then I can definitively say, this is this workload and this workload only.
Mm-hmm.
But the bigger array where I have available spindles now is a shared environment. Now, the DAS SCSI arrays will be mine exclusively.
Okay.
And they're configurable as well in terms of turning off cache.
Mm-hmm.
The left-hand cabinets are mine exclusively. They are not configurable
mm.
in terms of turning off too much of the cache.
Mm.
I believe you can turn off write caching,
mm.
but I think they do read caching and you just don't get a say in it,
mm.
which is kind of unfortunate because it's unfortunate.
It makes a lot of sense,
yeah.
to not allow, I mean, disabling read caching doesn't make much sense except for performance benchmarking.
Right.
Right. But write buffering, it makes sense even for, you know, production.
Because mm-hmm.
you might have reliability requirements, durability requirements for databases and things like that. Yeah. Do any of these arrays have NVRAM, any
mm-hmm.
sort of NVRAM? Yeah, they do.
And you can turn off write caching?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns off write caching on its own, and it goes into write-through mode if it detects the battery is missing or degraded,
mm.
in terms of the battery not being able to sustain
mm.
X many hours of being offline
mm.
for the NVRAM.
It is typically much smaller than that, right? Not hours. It's typically maybe minutes, which is just about sufficient to dump all the contents of the RAM to disk.
These are fairly large batteries.
Yeah.
They're bricks about this big. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think you can run...
You can run off of them for a while.
Well, you can't run the spindle.
Mm.
But if the cabinet were shut down, I believe it holds in cache,
mm.
the right cache, for a substantial amount of time.
I see. Yeah, that would make sense.
Long enough to essentially pull it out of a rack, open it up,
mm.
service whatever parts have failed, put it back together, put it back in Iraq, and bring it back into operations.
I
and that could be several hours.
I see. So if you lose power, you don't have a way to keep spinning the spindles. So you have to hold it in RAM. And therefore, you need a battery that lasts much longer than just enough to dump RAM contents into disk.
Mm-hmm.
Because the disk is not available.
Right.
I see. Hmm.
Unlike the EMC model,
hmm.
which is different, it maintains enough battery to keep the disk spinning to flush its cache.
To flush its cache, yeah, that's the one that I'm more familiar with.
Yeah, I've lost main power
hmm.
on my both power supplies. Therefore, I am in a failed state. Stop processing I/O. No more incoming. Flush the right cache to the disk. And even with that, it doesn't actually flush the right cache to its appropriate disks.
Yeah, it will just write it wherever it can, as quickly as possible.
The first five disks of the array on the first tray are dedicated to the operating system and the write cache. And in that failed mode, the higher any tray beyond the first tray, powers often fails because it's not plugged into the battery. Writes, however, are on the battery back tray and cache, and they get flushed.
There are five drives for the OS and the write cache. That's a lot, right?
It's a waste of space. It's a very thin slice of the five drives. You could use them in another LUN, but you're told not to.
I see.
For there are many
reasons. I guess they wanted to do a RAID 5 or a RAID 6 to make sure that that doesn't fail.
Right.
Independently, right?
I believe it's a RAID 5. It's a 4 plus 1. And you can use those drives. There's available space on them, but you are strongly discouraged from doing that.
Yeah.
For rebuild purposes, for disaster recovery purposes. The LUN that uses those first five drives, if you're tight on capacity, can have some very strange performance characteristics in certain scenarios. And you're told there's space and you can take it, but you don't want to. And it's because it becomes unpredictable. So we always leave them empty. We never use them.
Yeah. I mean, I was reading somewhere earlier, some blogger, where this guy was commenting that these days most drives, not these large arrays, but even single drives, the firmware is so big that they store most of the firmware on the disk itself, okay, instead of storing it in some ROM memory for the firmware. So there's very little ROM memory that is just sufficient for you to get going and load the actual firmware from disk. And then I was reading the article about the latent sector errors and bit errors on drives. So if you lose those bits, then
you're in trouble.
So I think one of the ways they deal with that is to make multiple copies of the firmware. So even if you with checksums and so on, you can detect if the firmware is in the integrity of the firmware, if it's okay. If not, then you go to a different copy and read off from there. I was thinking about the same thing with the OS for the arrays. And yes, it makes sense that they have it across a RAID 5, but probably they still want to have multiple copies, right, just for the bit error stuff.
I could probably figure out how much they're using, because they use a 520-byte sector, and there's 73-gig drives, and there's 60 gigs or so available for other people's use. So they're using, I don't know, maybe 12, 15 gigs total, which is the size of the cache plus probably multiple copies. You have to take from whatever's left, subtract the size of the cache. Because in a 100% write cache configuration, data would have to be able to write all of that, and what's left is probably divided between multiple copies of.
Do they specify how much cache is in there, or they do? So how much is the cache typically for these 900 spindle arrays?
16 gigs.
16 gigs? Yeah. Interesting.
8 or 16 gigs. Depending on, I think each controller has 8 gigs for a total of 16 gigs, but it's, the engineering gets bizarre because pieces of it are shared. Where if one storage processor write caches an incoming I/O, it is visible to the other one. So there's, and you have to set it up initially, your proportion of write to read caching, and that piece of it is shared between both of them, so that if the processor dies, there's transparent and media to fail over and multipathing, and my partner took in the write, but here you go. And he can, the other storage processor can pick it up. And I'm sure there's some black magic in there that makes that work. But there's, so there's an 8 per controller on the 960s, and then it steps down.
Right.
8, 4, 2, 1. And some of that is also used by the operating system.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, that's good. So about the model, I think the key model that we are looking for is this multiple workload consolidated model. Right? So I was thinking about what we spoke and maybe a few weeks back about how we could, you know, let's say I'm combining a 100% random with a 50% random. How do I know how much randomness is in the consolidated workload, right? So I said, well, let's start by just do a simple weighting of these two randomness metrics, randomness values with the load induced by each workload. Now, if you're going full blast, there is no sort of throttling of any kind. I guess we need to have, instead of IOPS, we need to have a different metric for the load induced by each workload. And perhaps we could think of the outstanding IOs as a potential load inducing metric, although I'm not really sure that's the right one to use. So I have like one IO from, let's say I have an outstanding IOs of 1 and 16. So I have 16 from one guy and 1 from the other guy, right? So if I just look at those 17 requests, the weighting of, just look at the randomness value for those 17 requests, then I know that the total randomness is going to be the weighted in the proportion of the outstanding IOs.
Weighted 16 to 1.
16 to 1, right? So that may be one way to do the weighting. Similarly for the read-write. Right? So we could go start with that and see what we get and see if that makes sense. And of course, for the performance model, we start with the Bayesian model, right, which basically uses the same sort of metrics that you have right now to predict the latency. And then once we have that, the total number of outstanding IOs will be just the summation of those two. The read write and the randomness will be sort of this weighted number. What else is there? There's one more. There were four, I remember. There were four.
Outstanding IOs, randomness, read to write. My guess.
IO size.
Yes.
IO size. So the transfer size will also be weighted in the same way, right? If I have, like, my average IO size would be a weighted value as well. And we could weight it by the outstanding IO. It seems to make sense, right? And we'll see how it works out. That might be a good start. The next thing is to, I mean, if we start with this, the next thing is to train the model, right? With some sample information from the storage system. And I guess we could sort of do the same thing that these guys did with the Bayesian work. So it's just going to be, you know, Bayesian with a more interesting consolidated workload model and applied to like this DSM SSM architecture.
So that's really what it is. We're looking at changing out the architecture.
Yeah.
In the back end.
Yeah.
Which is not what they did. They were more for a given black box array, tell me which one performs better, and I will move workloads around on it to average out the best performance.
Yeah, the load balancing.
The load balancing.
Yeah. So that's what we can start with in terms of the modeling of the for the consolidated workload. And let's see, I mean, I think it has to be more data-driven. Further refinement of this model needs to be data-driven. See where we are not exactly, matching up with the observations, and then we can fine-tune it from there.
Which is why I took an algorithm of this approach and say, just start, pair off everything possible.
Yeah.
Outstanding IOs, the transfer size, read, write, and sequentiality. And in that blizzard of tests, will come some of the information we need.
Sure.
So I think that was the other thing is, the more I did this, the more I realized I may not be able to get away from all pairs.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is a huge number.
That is a big number. Yeah. I mean, these guys, they told me, Ajay and Irfan, they told me that they spent 1 year running experiments. To get
and
all the data for their paper. I mean, they, of course, they probably had to discard a whole bunch of initial data, but in the end, they ran effectively for a whole year, all different kinds of experiments.
And one of the other things that I wanted to speak to you about was, what do you think a fair amount of time to run these micro benchmarks is?
For you need to have stable performance, right?
Right.
Before you stop running them. I mean, anything from, I would say, even 10 minutes is probably a reasonable time for the system to reach some steady state, because you're going full blast, and there is perhaps some warm-up time. 10 minutes is, in even for I/O, is a reasonably long period of time.
I had originally started with 5 minutes and was worried that that might be too much.
Oh, too long? Oh, because of the number of different combinations that you have.
Yeah. When I did some of the math, I realized that if I could automate the execution of the tests, and in order to run it for that prolonged period of the time, I'd have to build fault tolerance into the script. And I was going to basically do that by cycling the I/O meter process instead of just firing a new configuration into existing one, working a pointer to the point where someplace it might blow up on me. Fire it, run it once, shut it down. Fire it, run it once, shut it down.
So that you can collect all the statistics.
Right.
And before, yeah.
But for 5 minutes, I think the numbers came out to, and this wasn't even all pairs, almost 3 weeks for one model. And then I have to go do it all again.
For the combined
model. So I'm looking at 6 to 8 weeks of experimentation time.
I mean, considering the fact that these guys spent a year,
right?
I think we are looking at long experimental durations. But I know what you're saying. You probably want to have something to show at the end of the semester.
That was my concern.
Yeah. So I think 5 minutes is okay. And what you might have to do is a more coarse grained parameter configuration than what you have, so that you can at least show something at the end of the semester.
Because I'm trying to balance two things: a deliverable at the end of the semester, which of course is important to me because of the grade and the progress towards my degree, but in regards to a longer term, more thorough research project, I have no qualms letting it run for weeks on end.
Sure.
Because I have the equipment, I have the time.
Yeah. Well, in some sense, this forces you to take a coarse-grained view first and then go deep dive, right? So I think that's good, because from the coarse-grained data itself, you might be able to do some refinement of the model. And then when you go more fine-grained, you might be able to validate some of those refinements and invalidate others and do further refinements. So I would certainly recommend to do, coarse-grained first and then.
Okay. So what I might do is I might step in 20% increments.
Yeah, that does make sense. So I have 20% increments, even for both randomness as well as read-write. Right, and then
because that's 5 per transfer size times number of outstanding IOs. That's a manageable number.
Yeah, I mean, do you see 128K at all in transfer sizes?
I've been reading a lot and looking at validating workloads, and it appears as if transaction logging for OLTP, DSS, and mail systems like Exchange. Can range from 8K up to 128K, depending on what the database service, whether it's a mail database service or an OLTP SQL service, depending on what it is they see happening inside. And one of the references that Gulati makes was to a Microsoft site about workload benchmarking. And they say, yep, transaction log, 128K, 100% write, 100% sequential. And I beg to differ with that, but I'll take the 128K. I differ with the 100%. I would say 97, 97, 98, 98, because there is always the one transaction that aborts and causes you to back up somewhere in the log, read a little bit, and then keep going. And it's dispersed out in the larger scope of things.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, I think that's a really good plan of action. It's sure to keep you busy for the next 2 weeks, at least while I'm away. And then we can, you know, after I'm back, we can talk to discuss further.
And that's the kind of programming I like. Write a program that writes configurations for other programs.
That's smart, yeah.
Programs that write themselves as they go. Dynamic type living programs, if you will. That's always a fun type of thing to program.
Yeah.
And so I looked at it and I started to work them through by hand. And I said, oh, no. This is going to take me. I said, even if I can do one every 5 minutes, this will take me months just to get the configurations. And it's going to be very error-prone.
Yeah, so what do you use in Windows for scripting?
What I was going to use, I'm using the .NET, C#, the .NET programming languages for programming the configuration files. That generates a series of config files. And then I was going to use probably just straight shell script, command line, bash script from Windows to iterate through every... I was going to set up a for loop to go through every file in a given directory, which would be all of my configurations, and for that file, take the file, feed it to IO meter, and for the output, append from, it gives you back CSVs, and just copy those out into a separate directory. So my loop would essentially fire off an IO meter with a given input and output file name, run it, and go.
Do you have a Perl for Windows? Is there...
There is Perl.
There is Perl for Windows, right? Yeah. Sometimes Perl is useful for scripting as well. I mean, especially to, you know, for simple stuff. In Unix, we have lots of other things on the command line that we get to use as well.
Well, the Unix command line is grossly outdoes the Windows command line.
Yeah, but I also recently heard there's something called PowerShell.
That's the other one I was looking at using. I'm very well versed in batch because I've been doing it for years to the point where crazy things I've done in batch that shouldn't have been done in batch but just got done in batch because there was no other way short of writing a program and I didn't have the time. PowerShell is based in the .NET languages and is much more robust, and I've done a fair amount of PowerShell scripting, but I would not compare my experience in PowerShell to my experience in batch. But then again, I've also never programmed in Excel. And to process that many charts, it's something I have to do.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, because of the limitations of batch in terms of its error handling, its lack of robustness, I would probably PowerShell this.
That makes sense. Yeah, sure.
I would probably PowerShell it and run IO meter that way, and then go figure out whatever the horrible Excel programming APIs look like to say, okay, for every one of these workbooks, fire off an instance of Excel and go get sheet A, and from here to here is your data, and go generate some graphs for me, and then copy them all out, and then put them into this one master consolidated workbook, because there's no way I'm generating thousands of graphs by hand. You know, and the other thing I was considering doing is dumping all the numbers into a database as well, which makes for much easier aggregation and sorts of comparisons. And
yeah, that would make sense too. Yeah, you'll be generating a lot of data for sure.
Yeah, so much so it can't be dealt with manually. That I've already seen, and so I've realized that I have to automate it. And even with automation, running it as fast as I could would take weeks.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess
go with all pairs.
Yeah.
All pairs at 12. 20% granularity. I'll figure out a case to get past the 50%. I might just step 180, 60, 40 to catch the 50% with a ghost metric.
Yeah, I think that's, that would work too. All right, great. So.